Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Humans all over the planet are living longer, but really, why are they living longer is what we'd like to discuss today. And what does that answer to that question mean to our efforts to perhaps slow aging and prolong life? Our guest is joining us by phone from Chicago, and his name is Dr. Jay Olshansky. He's currently a professor of the School of Public Health in the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's a research associate at the Center for Aging at the University of Chicago and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. The focus of his research seems to be related to the upper limits of human longevity, exploring health and public policy implications associated with aging, forecasts about size and survival and age structure, for example, as we age, and the pursuit of scientific means to slow aging in people, and the global implications of the reemergence of infectious and parasitic diseases. Dr. Olshansky, it's a pleasure to have you back on Line One.
Delighted to be back.
Let me remind people right from the beginning, this is an issue or a topic where I expect to get quite a few phone calls. And if you have questions about why we're aging, what you can do to improve your aging, what's happening with aging, this is a good place to ask your questions. And the way to do that would be to call us locally at 550-8433. You can email us at line1. You spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line one, at alaskapublic.org, or we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Well, Jay, let's start with understanding what you do a little bit. I know you have a Ph.D. in sociology, but as you can tell from the description, or our listeners can tell from the description, you do a lot more than what seems like maybe just biodemography, if I were to put a name on it. How do you describe yourself? What do you do?
Basically, I was originally trained as a demographer, so I studied the statistics of aging and longevity, and then I retrained. I went back to school in my 40s and 50s and retrained in molecular and evolution biology and genetics of aging. So I'm really more, I actually consider myself more of a biologist.
Right.
Now, but I really try to study and understand why we live as long as we do and what we can do about it.
All right. That's what we want to talk about. And I did not catch somewhere. I missed all the re-education and evolutionary biology. So what is aging?
Well, aging is the, you know, it's funny that this question comes up all the time for researchers who do this for a living, and it's actually the one question that most of us stumble on, because you'll get a different answer just about, you know, from everyone that you ask. But the simple answer is aging is essentially the damage that accumulates to the building blocks of life, to the fats and the proteins and the carbohydrates. And it's a byproduct of living. It's like when you drive your car, you accumulate damage to parts and components. And in the human body, of course, we have these remarkable repair mechanisms that repair much of the damage, but the damage, the repair mechanisms are not perfect. Mm-hmm. And it's that lack of repair to the constant damage that's occurring during the process of life that accumulates that we call aging.
So when I ask what causes aging, and then the next question I got, what are the fundamental influences, they are things that have, that cause this wear and tear, and it could be some of our repair mechanisms biologically are not as good. It's things we do to ourselves, and then, as I've heard you write, that it's also somewhat luck from a injury standpoint.
Well, if you ask me what the most important thing is to achieve a long life, the answer is actually incredibly simple, and that would be to choose long-lived parents and grandparents. Mm. And if you're able to, you know, of course, that's a message that it's genetics, that genetics plays a very important role. But then even if you've inherited genes that allow you to essentially live longer or experience decelerated aging, there's still plenty that we can do to influence that process. But most of that influence is in the way of shortening life. So we, you know, frequently adopt unhealthy lifestyles. We smoke cigarettes. We drink alcohol excessively. We expose ourselves to the sun. too much. So we do lots of things that shorten our lives, but once you avoid those life-shortening behavioral risk factors, then the biological aging process marches on, unaltered by anything else that we do. We can influence how healthy we are along the way through diet and exercise, and there are other factors that influence the aging process along the way. But for the most part, the only control we have over our duration of life, this may sound controversial to some, is to shorten it. And we exercise that control all the time. So the goal, of course, is to do what we can to avoid the things that accelerate aging and let nature take its course.
So that's kind of a depressing message, I would think, to a lot of people. So you're saying this, if I put it in a different little framework, and you tell me if I'm wrong, that the single most important variable in your lifespan is your parents, how long your parents lived.
Yes, I would say genetics. I know that there's some people who argue that genetics only plays, roughly a 25 to 30% role in how long you live. It's not really quite true. In long-lived populations like in the United States, where most people born live beyond the age of 65, it's not genetics that's influencing the process. It's not the environment that's getting you to 65. It's the genetics first that's getting you there. What happens once you get up past the age of 65? That's partially within your control. And the quality of your life once you get out to older ages is certainly what you have some influence over. But genetics, you have the only way you can live an exceptionally long life is if you won the genetic lottery at birth. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can take somebody who is destined to die early because of inherited genes that are harmful and transform them into a centenarian, somebody who lives past 100. Mm-hmm. And, the life expectancy increases that we've experienced in the last 50 to 100 years are not a result of any influence we've had over biological aging. It's because we've altered the environment around us. We've created, these insulated indoor living and working environments. We've cleaned up our water. We've gotten rid of sewage. So we've gotten rid of many of the things that kill us early, and now we're allowing the biological aging process to express itself by allowing people to live into older ages. It's, there was sort of an unusual trade-off that occurred. We used to die from infectious diseases often at very young ages. We dramatically reduced early age mortality. We, as a result, we got to live about 30 years longer on average from 50 to about 80 today. But the price we had to pay for our extended lives is the rise of heart disease, cancer, stroke, and Alzheimer's. So it's not necessarily a depressing message. It's a realistic message. This is what happens to aging bodies. And, we know what happens to the aging bodies of other living things, and it's pretty much the same thing.
So in my introduction, I said we are living longer, and it's true around the planet that we're living longer, and we're healthier than we've ever been. And I like to say there's pretty good evidence we're wealthier than we've ever been, and I attribute that to science and technology to a large degree. But so that the fact that we're living much longer is not that we're really healthier, it's just that we are, as you said, changed the environment, which again is, it really kind of goes against the flow of, well, you need to get out there and keep exercising, you need to watch what you eat and all that. And I guess the evidence would be there were people in 1920 that lived to 70 or 80. There's just more of us living there longer because we don't die of accident, we don't die of infections, we don't die of things that used to keep us from getting to that age, that old elderly age.
Well, actually, there's evidence that people lived to 100 more than 2,000 years ago.
Right, okay.
So there have always been long-lived people among us, but very few of them historically. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning of the 20th century, public health had a very powerful impact on reducing the risk of early age mortality, primarily from infectious diseases. So really, the genetics of humans has never changed. Certainly in the last 250,000 years, the prospects for how long we could live have not been altered. You could have taken somebody from 2,000 years ago, brought them into the present, and they could live just the same kind of life that we live today. You could teach them calculus. You can give, train them to become an MD, and they really would not have been any different. They might have been hardier physically than some of us today, but for the most part, we haven't really changed at all. So the control that we've taken is in the environment. Now, you said something interesting earlier about diet and exercise. Look, these are the only equivalent of a fountain of youth that exists today. If you ask me what's the greatest control that we have, I mean, aside from choosing long-lived parents and grandparents, what's the next best thing that you can do? Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you need to avoid the risk factors that lead to accelerated aging. So that's the first thing. Just avoid the things that shorten life. We all know what those are. Your mother told you what those are. But the next best thing, of course, is diet and exercise. And that is what has the greatest influence on health and quality of life. And you and I talked very briefly before this interview began about the powerful impact of education. And I can't emphasize this enough. If you talk about a trump card, that has an extraordinarily powerful influence on the quality of your life, the length of your life, exactly how you live life, it would be education. It's one of the most important socioeconomic factors that influences health, quality, and duration of life. We have control over that to some extent, and it's just one of the most powerful trump cards there is.
Why? Why is education, what is it about education that allows us to have better control of everything, it sounds like, if I oversimplify it, than our genes?
Well, think of it this way. Education is a proxy for lots of other things in our world that we consider to be favorable to health and longevity. So education is directly associated with income. It's directly associated with access to health care. It's directly associated with access to high-quality jobs. Individuals who are educated make wiser decisions about how to monitor their bodies and treat conditions when they arise. So all of us, no matter how well-educated or not we may be, we are going to face health problems as we grow older. All of us will experience these issues. How you deal with them is heavily influenced by your level of education, and how you deal with them will have a powerful influence on quality and duration of life. The classic example is diabetes treatment. Individuals who are more highly educated will be very careful in treating their diabetes. We've seen in some subgroups of the population that aren't as highly educated, they don't monitor their diabetes nearly as effectively. They're not listening to their doctor. They're not taking their medication. So education just plays itself out in so many positive ways. And the general rule is the more you get, the more the benefit.
And yet, we now got to get political or philosophical, and yet it seems to me, I'm looking locally, at least what I know the best, we're struggling with money to educate our kids. We're struggling to know how to educate our kids effectively. As a pediatrician, I'm increasingly aware that the first 3 years before kids ever get into structured school is maybe extremely important for the rest of their life and their health. So what are we doing? We're failing to educate the policymakers?
Well, I'm completely apolitical, so I won't jump into any political fray, but you're right. I mean, certainly what's happening in those first couple of years is critical. Look, I have a new grandson. He's a year and a half old. My daughter is a teacher, and she and her husband have been absolutely meticulous about doing everything they can to create an enriched environment for him as he's growing up, and that's really what all of us should be doing, because those formative years, those first couple of years, are really important for development. And how easy or difficult it becomes for that child when they reach their school age years. So, yeah, I mean, it begins early and it moves on through puberty. I'm not just talking about college education. I'm talking about the education throughout life beginning very early. So it's a long drawn out process.
Yeah, another quote I just heard recently is education doesn't start the first day of school; it starts the first day of life.
Yes.
All right, we have a caller, and I want to take Mike. But when I'm doing that, let me remind everybody: if you've got questions or comments, our local number in Anchorage is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address: line1@alaskapublic.org. Mike, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for your program. I was curious about the human growth hormone and specifically about the synthetic human growth hormones. What's you guys' take on that?
As a way to make you healthier and live longer?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Okay. Dr. Olshansky, how about human growth hormone? Does that do any good?
For children who are growth hormone deficient and for a couple of other conditions, growth hormone actually is a reasonable and legitimate intervention. I actually know about this because my son was growth hormone deficient, and he ended up getting growth hormone for a couple of years to attain a normal height. But in terms of adults using it, absolutely stay away from growth hormone. There's very strong evidence to suggest that growth hormone is a biologically active compound, which means, unlike some other things that people input into their bodies, it actually does something. The problem is that you do not want to introduce a growth factor into a body that where the cells have progressed towards a cancerous state. There's evidence to suggest that there are side effects that are associated with the use of growth hormone. In adults, it's illegal to use it for any purpose other than the legitimate purposes that have been documented by the FDA. So I would stay away from it. I think some of the physicians who are administering it to their patients under off-label use as a so-called anti-aging intervention are essentially conducting a biological experiment on their own patients. And the evidence suggests that we should be staying away from it. And I'd point out, by the way, that the purported benefits of growth hormone are increased muscle mass, mental acuity, skin elasticity. There's some purported benefits associated with it, all of which you can get for free doing one thing. Any idea what that is?
Of course.
Exercise.
Yeah.
All of the benefits that have been associated with growth hormone you get for free with exercise, so stay away from
it. Well, good. I'm glad because I was thinking about ordering some, out of the magazine I got.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Yep. And there's downsides. It is an insulin resistant, so it increases likelihood of glucose intolerance and diabetes. Anyway, we don't want to go there. From a medical standpoint, that's not a wise choice. But while we're on the topic of medications, how about if we talk about metformin? There are some interesting bits of information I'm reading and some real good research beginning to look at the effects of metformin. I know we're way off topic. We're kind of moving along, but I thought I'd bring it in since we're talking about things like growth hormone.
Well, actually, we're right on topic, okay. as it turns out.
All right.
Of course, you're always on topic. So, look, pick up this week's issue of Time Magazine. You'll see a very nice detailed story about metformin in there. And for those of you who aren't familiar, metformin is a compound that's been used for decades to treat diabetes. It's safe. It's effective. It's been approved by the FDA. There is evidence to suggest, and I'll say this carefully, initial evidence to suggest that metformin may have side effects. The side effects may be positive. The positive side effects might be decelerated aging, a slowdown and the biological process of aging that delays the onset of many, if not all, fatal and disabling diseases simultaneously. There is an effort to conduct a clinical trial on metformin to determine whether or not it does what these scientists think it may do. It's one of many compounds that are being studied. It's one of many interventions that are being studied now. with the goal of slowing down the biological process of aging. So I said to you earlier that, you know, that aging marches on unaltered by anything that we do. There's now reason to believe that science is progressing fairly rapidly towards an intervention that can slow down that process. Now, how do we know this can be done? Two ways. One is that the science has already documented the fact that aging can be slowed down in other species. That has already been well documented. It's been known for a while. But there's reason to believe that in humans, there are people walking around among us who are probably already experiencing decelerated aging. You know them as centenarians or supercentenarians, people who are living past 110. And probably the way in which they got there, the way in which they made it to 100 or 110, is that somehow they were not experiencing 1 year of biological time that was matched to 1 year of clock time. In other words, they were experiencing within their bodies a decelerated aging process. And that's what researchers now are trying to find. Are the mechanisms through which this is happening? It's likely to be a genetic force that's influencing decelerated aging in these people. Metformin may be one of those compounds that has this effect. So it's really exciting work in the field. And keep in mind, the goal here is not life extension. We're not trying to make people live longer with these interventions. The goal is health extension. That's the only thing we are trying to pursue.
And I guess I think it's is apropos now, especially as in discussions about the growth hormone question earlier, that these clinical trials are designed to see if the product, the chemical, the medication, the drug is effective, and is the risk-benefit ratio worthwhile? What are the side effects? Everything's got side effects. So we're not – what I hear you saying is that we're not there yet. We're beginning to understand the aging process a little bit better. We're beginning to understand biological systems better and better and better, and we're beginning to test some products, but we don't really know the risk-benefit ratio on anything at this point to say that we can extend life or health safely with medications. Is that true or false, or do you need to correct me?
Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. You know, the reason why we do clinical trials is because we don't know the answers yet. Right. There's suggestive evidence in the scientific literature to indicate that there may be some benefit associated with this intervention. There was similar evidence to suggest that resveratrol, the compound in red grapes, may have had the same effect, so researchers are still studying that. There's lots of other interventions that researchers are pursuing now. Some researchers are actually studying the genetics of exceptionally long-lived people to figure out what it is about them that's protecting them. But you're right. It's, you know, we shouldn't be taking metformin right now with the idea that we can slow aging. Wait for the clinical trials to be done. I know some people are impatient and they don't want to wait. But look, sometimes when we don't wait and we start taking interventions like growth hormone, for example, before the clinical trials are in, harm can be done. And that's really the one thing that we want to prevent at all costs. So we're not just determining safety, which we know, by the way, with metformin is already safe. We're trying to determine efficacy. Does it actually do what we say it does? If we think it's going to slow down biological aging, we need definitive proof that that's exactly what it does. Now, I would point out, by the way, that we've had recent meetings with the Food and Drug Administration in Washington, D.C., to determine whether or not we could generate research studies designed to have multiple disease endpoints as the way in which these research projects should be done. And we succeeded in having these initial meetings with the FDA, and they understood that these projects that we were proposing to slow aging really were designed to go after multiple disease endpoints and not just one. And you realize that most research now is done with one intervention, one disease. One intervention, one disease. But anything that goes after aging has to have multiple disease endpoints. And that's where we're headed. But again, as you indicated, don't Don't do anything now. If anyone's telling you that they can slow, stop, or reverse aging with any intervention, stay away. Cover your checkbook and don't give them any money because it's not ready for prime time.
Let's take another call, and then I'm going to have to do our mid-break segue. Eve, you're on line one.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I was wondering about your knowledge and your opinion on cupping therapy and biomagnetic therapies and how that might affect the aging process of the body. And I can take my answer off the air.
All right. I don't know if you heard that. Cupping therapy and biomagnetic energy.
Eve, it'll be a very short answer. I'm sorry, but I don't really know anything about cupping therapy. I've heard something about biomagnetic therapy, but I don't know any of the research that might be associated with it, so I just don't know. In the world of science, when we don't know, we have to say that, and this is one of those instances. I just don't know.
And I'm going to go a little bit further in saying it's unlikely that there is good evidence that either of those are safe and effective, or you would probably know.
Well, look, there's lots of stories that have been in the news about how to cure cancer, about how to treat this disease or that disease, how to eliminate diseases. Right. Look, if there was an intervention that could cure a disease, trust me, it would be on the market already. So I'm always reluctant when I'm hesitant when I hear stories about, exaggerated claims about interventions or products. I don't know if this would fall into that category or not, but, if somebody's making a claim and it sounds too good to be true, especially if they're talking about a cure for most diseases, especially chronic fatal disabling diseases, it's just not true.
All right. Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number again is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short one-minute break, and we'll continue our discussion on what we know about human aging and longevity with our guest, Dr. Jay Olshansky of the University of Illinois at Chicago. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Joining us today by telephone is Dr. Jay Olshansky, who is an authority on various aspects of human aging. He's currently a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago and a research associate for the Center on Aging at the University of Illinois at Chicago is where he's in the School of Public Health, and he's a research associate at the University of Chicago on the Center on Aging and also at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. You can reach us today if you have questions or comments about topics related to human aging and longevity by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number, if you're in town, is 550-8433, and if you're listening and would like a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Please remember this program repeats. I recording tonight between 8 and 9 Monday evening local time in Anchorage, and that will be a taped recording, so we won't be able to answer your questions. You can always go to alaskapublic.org and listen to the program again. It'll be in our archives, or refer someone that you'd like to have listen to the program. Let's see. Where do we go? What about... So I guess to sum up what I have heard you say is one of the principal, most important factor in how an individual is going, how long the individual is going to live, is a biological determinant, primarily coming through genetics from our parents. But our behaviors outside of that are another significant, can be a significant contributing. So that if we have good genes, we might waste those genes by our behaviors that could lead to more problems. One in the past that's been an issue has been smoking. Another now that may be replacing that and maybe worse that you'd hinted at before the program is obesity. Do you want to comment on what we know about the demography, demographics of the effect of smoking? And now as we start wondering, are we going to continue to have an aging population based on our problems with obesity?
Well, I mean, smoking, you know, we discovered decades ago is harmful. The science is now definitive. It shortens lives for the vast majority of the people who smoke. Sometimes the shortened lives are dramatic. Although I will point out, and it's just a point of interest, that the longest-lived person in the world, her name was Jeanne Calmon, from southern France. She made it to 122. She smoked for 100 years. So this is not a license to your listeners to smoke. It's basically an indication that, for her anyway, smoking was not a risk factor.
She may have had very good genes that clean up the problems associated with
smoking. The funny thing is, researchers studied the genetics of Jeanne Calmon. They went back seven generations and discovered that her ancestors, on average, lived into their 70s during a time in which average duration of life in France was in the 40s. Mm-hmm. So there's no question there's a very strong genetic component there. Mm-hmm. Now, obesity is a somewhat different story. Now, smoking prevalence has declined pretty dramatically in the United States. It's risen elsewhere, but in the U.S. it's gone down dramatically, and we've reaped the benefits. I mean, there have been reductions in cardiovascular disease. There have been reductions in cancer associated with that. So we've had huge benefits associated with smoking reduction. But on the flip side, since the 1980s, we've had a rather dramatic increase in obesity. Now, there's two things going on here. One is the adult onset obesity epidemic that began about 3.5 to 4 decades ago. And you now see it in the baby boom generation, those born between 1946 and 1964, where the levels of obesity in this generation are extraordinarily high. The levels of frailty and disability among the baby boomers is not favorable. We are not reaching older ages healthier than previous generations. To the contrary, in general, we are less healthy as a cohort than the generations born before us. And then the real worrisome problem is childhood obesity. So now you've got a generation that just a couple of decades ago this process began, where instead of acquiring obesity as an adult, children began to become obese, which means they're acquiring their obesity decades earlier than the generations that preceded them. So the dangers associated with obesity, which is, you know, diabetes and joint problems and cardiovascular disease and cancer, those are acquired much earlier in life. So you've got two generations that are in trouble associated with obesity, and it's risen quite dramatically just in the last couple of decades. And the problem with obesity, just like with smoking, is that there's a latent effect, which means you can become obese now, but the harmful effect may not be seen for a couple of decades. It was the same thing with smoking. You know, if you looked at smokers who began in their, you know, teens, 20s, and 30s years ago, and you waited a couple of decades, you might not have concluded it was that harmful. You had to wait long enough to see the negative effects, and that's the situation we're in with obesity. The troubling thing is that we're actually already starting to see the negative effects of obesity on health and quality of life, and it's very disheartening to see. So there's some troubling signs in terms of risk factors in the population that are already presenting themselves, It's across the globe, I will point out. Obesity is not just within the United States. It's a global epidemic, and the dangers there are real, and, you know, the population needs to be aware of this, for sure.
I have another caller. I'll go ahead and take that call and remind listeners one more time, our local number, 550-8433, if you've got questions about aging and longevity of humans. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Devin, you're on line one.
Yeah, I was wanting to ask a question about poly-A-tails, about RNA, and if there's any correlation between longevity and the keeping of poly-A-tails.
I'm not understanding the poly. Say that again. Maybe Dr. Olshansky understands it, but I don't.
Yeah, the poly A tail. It's a series of DNAs at the end of RNA that helps with transcription, and
okay.
As the age that tends to get whittled away.
Yeah, yeah. Does that have something to do with like telomeres?
Yeah, I think it just kind of like cuts into the actual genetic sequencing of the amino acids.
Okay, all right. Let me, Dr. Olshansky, did you catch that?
Yeah, actually, at first I thought he was talking about a poly pill.
Yeah.
And I know that there was an effort underway a while ago to combine a number of drugs into one called a poly pill. This sounds like it's something different. And I'll admit I'm not as familiar with this as perhaps I should be. So I'm not going to be able to answer this one. I don't know. I know that the story about telomeres and telomere shortening, you know, for the listeners who aren't familiar with this, every time a cell divides, a little piece of the end of the DNA is essentially lopped off. Those are called telomeres, and the process is called telomere shortening. And there's an enzyme called telomerase that exists that influences this process. And what, interestingly enough, cancer cells, for the most part, don't ever lose their telomeres when they split. They just go on indefinitely, and it has to do with the amount of telomerase that exists. And people have suggested, by the way, that if you introduce this enzyme, telomerase, into people's bodies, that the cells will just divide indefinitely and will live forever, or at least a whole lot longer than we do now. And unfortunately, I don't think it'll work quite that way. In all likelihood, if we introduced this enzyme, telomerase, we would probably just become one big cancer cell. So it's not generally a good idea to fiddle with cell division in this regard, but I don't know if the example that Devin provided falls into that category or not.
That help, Devin?
Yeah, it's great. Thanks.
All right, thanks for your call. Another thing I have enjoyed learning about, and I think it's very important for us to put our own culture in some perspective, as we think often we have the best healthcare systems. And I've tried to explain, when we really look at it, there's some problems with our healthcare system and our health as related to the many of the rest of the industrialized world. And as I look at the data, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, but I want you to explain it if I'm right, is that our longevity, humans in the United States are living longer, but we're actually probably losing ground to a lot of the rest of the world. If that's true, why might that be?
It is true. It's actually very disheartening to see this. When you look at trends in longevity in the U.S. and you look at trends in the rest of the developed world, we are moving. Our life expectancy is rising in general very slowly for the population. There has been some stagnation of late, but other countries seem to be doing better. You know, I can tell you there have been a number of studies that have come out on U.S. data just within the last couple of years suggesting a rather dramatic increase in deaths associated with drugs, with non-prescription mm-hmm. drug use, with accidents, homicide, and suicide have risen in the United States, and it's a very disturbing trend. I published on this a couple of years ago demonstrating a five-year drop in life expectancy for the least educated white men and women in the United States, something I wasn't really expecting. And researchers subsequently determined that it was drug use that was associated with this process. So there's something very unusual going on in the U.S. that doesn't seem to be happening elsewhere. It's not what's going on at early ages. It's not really what's going on at older ages. It's what's going on at middle ages in the U.S. that seems to be disturbing. And I would add to that, by the way, that the obesity epidemic in the U.S. is worse than in almost any other country. Mexico is pretty bad, but we've done a lot of harm to our own health just within the last couple of decades. This is self-inflicted, and we're just not seeing this happening in other countries. I'm not entirely sure what we can do about this. There have been efforts to go after obesity. There have been efforts to reduce deaths from non-prescription drug use. That's not worked very effectively. So, and then you've got poverty in the United States. The disparities that exist in longevity in the U.S. are huge. There are some subgroups in the U.S., and you could look at this by zip code, by the way, where people who literally live across the street from each other can have a difference in life expectancy of 10 to 12 years. Those that are experiencing the lower life expectancy are essentially living in the middle of the 20th century. About 60 or 70, it's as if they were living 60 or 70 years ago in terms of their mortality risk, their access to health care, their access to high-quality food. They're living in a different world. The paper that my colleagues and I published on this a few years ago, the original title we had was The Dawn of Aging, Two Americas. We were basically arguing that there's two subgroups within the U.S., some that are highly educated, that are wealthy, that are doing exceptionally well. They're experiencing accelerated reductions in death rates and greater longevity. And then on the flip side, other subgroups that are doing very poorly, high drug use, higher mortality, high obesity, lower education. It's disheartening to see in the United States. You can actually see it in downtown Chicago, where literally one zip code next to the other has a difference in life expectancy of somewhere between 7 to 10 years. So.
And there is a well-established bit of evidence that socioeconomic variation is a predictor of health. I'm not talking about death here. I've done some shows on this, and there's quite a bit of public health data. So that countries where there is less separation in wealth between the highest paid and the lowest paid actually have better health than a country like ours, where the differential between the highest and the lowest has begun to separate over the last 25 or 50 years and seems to be correlated to worsening health outcomes in the lower socioeconomic groups.
Yes. So the way to think of it is this way. The harmful effects of being poor and less educated today are significantly worse than they were a couple of decades ago. I'm not entirely sure why that is the case. There's evidence to suggest some of the reason may be non-prescription drug use or even prescription drug use, but there's something else going on. And I would point out, by the way, that the issue of race is also important here. If you look at subgroups of the population by race, and let's use the Census Bureau classification of black, white, and Hispanic to simplify things, in general, you're seeing rather dramatic increases or dramatic differences between blacks and whites in the United States. It's worth pointing out, by the way, that one of the longest-lived subgroups in the United States is Hispanics, which a lot of people would not have expected because of an association with lower socioeconomic status in general. But a lot of this may be associated with the fact that Hispanic longevity and mortality is heavily influenced by the fact that we're talking about first-generation migrants who seem to be healthier than the population from which they came. So there's very unusual dynamics going on within the United States because we're so diverse. That diversity is our advantage in general, but that diversity is also leading to some of the variation that we see in longevity.
I want to take our next caller, but before I do that, I will mention that I brought with me a copy of an article from the New York Times this morning on an opinion page, and it's entitled "Why Are White Death Rates Rising?" If we have time, I'll get into this issue, this comment, and the evidence supporting it a little bit later. But it's another source of information that gets into this complexity of what's happening with our population health right now. Michael, you're on line one.
Yeah, thank you. Great show. You talked about the epidemic of obesity and the power of exercise. I was wondering also about your diet. There's research about the Mediterranean diet being very helpful for long-lived and fruits and vegetables with their antioxidant properties. And so I just wondered if you can comment of what you might think would be the best diet to take.
Okay, great question.
Yeah, great question. And Michael's right. The Mediterranean diet has been very well documented to be associated with lower risk of cardiovascular disease, lower total mortality in general, higher quality of life in general in those subgroups of the population that are eating a Mediterranean diet in general. And I would include, by the way, the emphasis on not just the Mediterranean diet, but eating less in general. You know, eating a large quantity of a Mediterranean foods is not healthy either. But yes, no question. If I didn't mention diet, it was my mistake. Diet and exercise, I would argue, are the only equivalent of a fountain of youth that exists today. So you're right, but reemphasize that eat less, and the Mediterranean diet is absolutely the right way to go. You've seen some interesting changes in dietary habits and recommendations, even from various organizations, just within the last couple of years. I'm going to sort of clue you in on where I think things are headed next in the world of diet. I think in general, you know, when we fill our plate up with food at dinner, we generally take a piece of meat and stick it in the middle, and then we have side dishes. And that's where the vegetables come in, and you know, you have a large piece of meat and then all these fruits and vegetables on the side if that. Or it may just be potatoes. And I think in the future, the dietary recommendations are going to be that what you fill your plate with is primarily fruits and vegetables, plant foods in general, and your side dish should be the meat. And I think that's simple solution may be sufficient to solve some of the major problems we see, both in terms of childhood obesity and adult onset obesity. Sometimes the solutions are incredibly simple, and that may be the direction that we're headed in the future.
Mike? Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for your call.
I appreciate that. And I think especially childhood obesity has to be tackled here in the United States because it's going to add a lot of cost to our health care system as years go on.
Looks like
Absolutely.
It will. You're right. All right. Let me follow through on the diet issue and ask you a little bit more about one area that has gotten a lot of publicity, and that's caloric restriction. No question, to lose weight, we got to take in less calories than we burn off. You gain weight because you put in more calories than you're burning off. But now there's also this issue of taking in less than we really need in caloric restriction and longevity. Where do we stand on that?
Well, there is not evidence to indicate that reducing your caloric intake is going to make you live longer. It's going to make there's no evidence that it'll make people live longer. The evidence that's come out recently on primates suggests that it will improve quality of life, but not have an impact on length of life. Part of the problem here is that some researchers have taken the work that's been done on shorter-lived animals like mice and dogs and rats, and you know they perform caloric restriction on these animals, and they have actually lived longer. And actually, the shorter the species, shorter lived the species, the longer, the greater the longevity benefit that's associated with CR. The greater the longevity of the species, the less the benefit of CR. In fact, that book that I wrote with my colleague called A Measured Breath of Life was designed specifically to address this very issue of why you can't go from short-lived species to long-lived species with regard to caloric restriction. It simply is not going to work. It doesn't mean that we're not going to benefit from reducing our caloric intake, principally because we eat too much. in general throughout throughout the world. But CR is caloric restriction generally is not a reasonable approach. Just sort of a sensible approach to diet is the right thing to do. And I would emphasize, by the way, one of my absolute favorite foods is right in your backyard, which would be fresh wild Alaskan salmon. Doesn't get any better than that. I had some last night.
Yep. I would second that. Thanks very much for your comments on this. We have an email, and I'm not sure I understand it. And if you don't understand the reference here, then we'll have to move on. But I think it's worth asking because it is being asked by a physician, so I think it's a good question. I just may not know what she's dealing with. It says, would you guys be able to touch upon the dietary habits of people living in blue zones, if you have a chance? I don't know what blue zones mean. Do you know?
Yes, I do. So this is the work of Dan Buettner,
okay,
who has basically traveled to different parts of the world. Some very interesting work, I think, where he's identified subgroups of the population that seem to have individuals that live exceptionally long lives. So Okinawa in Japan is one of those examples. There's Sardinia in Italy. There's probably at least a half a dozen other places where these, you can call them hot spots for exceptional longevity. They're called blue zones, and I think there's very powerful evidence to indicate that many of these folks are on the equivalent of a Mediterranean diet, or at least they're eating less. They certainly do not experience the levels of obesity and diabetes and heart disease that the rest of us experience. So there's very powerful evidence to suggest that these subgroups exist, that they're real. I would emphasize, by the way, the study of the genetics of these people, because mm-hmm. some subgroups, mm-hmm. If I recall, in Italy, mm-hmm. there was something very peculiar about the fat molecules that existed in the individuals in one particular part of Italy where the risk of cardiovascular disease was at or near zero in these individuals, and it had to do with a particular fat circulating in their body.
Mm-hmm.
So the
mm-hmm.
genetics of these subgroups of the population, I think, is particularly fascinating, but there's no question there's an environmental mm-hmm. influence as well. So the blue zones are real. There are subgroups that live exceptionally long lives, and we have a lot to learn from those folks, to be sure.
This raises a very interesting question that a lot of listeners may not want to get into it this well. But my next question would be: have we done studies controlling for the genetics, which you answered? But what about if you take those individuals who living in these blue zones and you move them into the United States, for example, what happens to their longevity then? And what I'm getting at is evidence that certainly allergies, our immune response changes based on where you live. We see much evidence of, and this gets into epigenetic kinds of things that affect our genome, some environmental factors that affect our genome. So I'd wonder if that study, or has that been looked at in individuals from blue zones once they move into a different environment?
Yeah, great question. So that the study for about people moving from blue zones hasn't been done as far as I know, but the equivalent has been done. There are individuals who moved from Japan, which is one of the longest-lived populations in the world, to Hawaii, maybe even California, if I recall correctly, where these studies were done. And sure enough, exactly what you would expect would happen happened, and that is they acquire the mortality risk of the population that they move toward, mm-hmm. Which means they experience lower life expectancy, higher levels of frailty and disability. So you can basically take somebody who has the potential to live a long life, and it's very easy to shorten life. That's sort of one of the easiest things to do is to shorten it. It's very difficult to lengthen it. Now, so the flip side is sort of the other question that would be the obvious one to ask, and that is, what if you move to a blue zone?
Mm-hmm.
As long as you adopt the lifestyle of the local population, chances are you would benefit from whatever lifestyle advantage they have. The only problem is that you're not benefiting from the genetics of those individuals.
That's medical tourism in spades, I guess.
Never quite that easy, is it?
All right. Quick question, then I'll ask you a little one that's a little bit harder, I think. What's the evidence that plastics are affecting overall health? This comes from an email. Anything along plastics that you would comment
about? Not that I know of. Look, you know, I get this question all the time about pollutants, about how we've managed to destroy our food supply. We have less nutritious foods. There's air pollution. Well, look, during the time in which we've done all of these so-called harmful things to the environment and the introduction of plastics, and don't get me wrong, I am an environmentalist, but during the time in which we've done all of these things, life expectancy has done nothing but rise. So I don't think that there's that much of an impact as one might imagine. But I wouldn't discount the possibility that some of these things that we're introducing into our environment might be influencing our quality of life. It's entirely possible, by the way, that the obesity epidemic itself may have been influenced by the introduction of antibiotics in the 1980s. There's at least suggestive evidence that what's going on inside the gut may be having a profound influence on our health and quality of life. So I don't discount many of these ideas, and there's certainly suggestive evidence to indicate that some things that we might not ordinarily think are powerful are in fact much more powerful than we might imagine.
We only have 2 minutes, but I want to ask you, why do women live longer than men?
Well, there's plenty of jokes that I could tell about this, but I'm going to stay away from them. Look, throughout almost the entire animal world, females live longer than males. Now, which tells you that there's a biological component that is influencing this. Even when you control for all other factors that might influence, you know, differences in longevity between males and females, it could be income, education, occupation, a whole slew of things. Even if you control for all of those, females still live longer than males. So I'm afraid I can't answer this. There's likely to be a very strong genetic influence that's controlling this. And, you know, you do see some rather dramatic impacts of age at menopause, for example, on duration of life. You know, women who go through natural menopause late tend to live significantly longer than women who go through natural menopause early, which tells you there's a very strong genetic component that's influencing this process. It's all related to reproduction. If you study evolution biology, you quickly learn that how long we live is influenced by the genetic potential for reproduction, by fecundity, and that there is some influence that we can have over that process, but not nearly as much as you might imagine.
All right, so choose your parents well. If you can't do that, eat well, eat a little bit less, exercise a little bit more. Other than that, we're still researching. Is that the story?
Yes, but we're very close to an intervention that has the potential to slow aging. Okay. Pick up this week's issue of Time magazine. Okay. There's plenty of stories in there on the topic. It's very exciting work. If people aren't familiar with it, they need to become familiar with it, because this, in my view, is the next great revolution in public health. It's on our doorstep.
It has been a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time, Dr. Olshansky.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be on again.
All right. My thanks again to Dr. Olshansky. Remember, he's professor of the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago. If you want to continue this discussion on human aging, you can join KSK on Facebook. You can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org, where you can also find our archives. Next week, Prentice Pemberton's going to be back as the co-host, and you're going to continue a discussion on historical trauma and how this affects both countries, cultures, and communities. Please join him February 29th at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron was gracious enough to be our audio engineer today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a very great day, and watch what you eat.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.